Hello, and welcome to this episode of Chronicles, where we're going to be discussing the 1899 novella, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, a very, very famous and wonderfully controversial text. So, I suppose let's just begin with a little bit about Joseph Conrad himself. Joseph Conrad was actually not British by birth, although it became his adoptive country later in his life, and he became one of the most remarkable writers in the English language. Conrad's birth was and heritage was actually Poland, and specifically Poland as annexed by the Russian Empire and partitioned. And so his father was very, very instrumental in constantly rebelling against the Russian Empire. And this meant that Conrad grew up without very much stability in his life. In fact, in 1865, he and his family were even forcibly exiled to northern Russia as punishment for rebellion. And he lost his mother at quite an early age. From then on, when Conrad was 8 years old, his father took on work translating texts into Polish. And one of the first was Shakespeare. And so Conrad grew up from an early age slowly being inculcated with a love of the English language itself. He also watched his father work as he translated other works by Victor Hugo, Dickens and Thackeray, and other such famous writers of the age. And so Heart of Darkness is very much a tale, a novella, inspired by Conrad's own personal life, because from there and moving away from Poland and towards Western Europe, Conrad went on to have a great deal of time seafaring, sailing across the world, very, very extensively, might I add. He went as far as Borneo and the Caribbean and Singapore, and most importantly for the text that we're going to be discussing, the Congo. And this is a tale where Conrad's experiences in the Congo is not necessarily autobiographical, but it is a story born out of his impressions of what he saw firsthand with King Leopold II of Belgium's personal private colony, which was the only one in the world at that time, and possibly ever, although don't quote me on that, but it was certainly the only private colony that actually existed in the world at that time, as in it wasn't managed by the Belgian state, but rather by direct diktat from King Leopold II. Conrad had a very complicated relationship with colonialism, even though at the very, very end of the 19th century, it very much simply was the default European worldview of the time. But this shouldn't be interpreted as Conrad being akin to modern-day post-colonialists who seem to just use the history from 150 years ago to whip European nations today into submission. Heart of Darkness, rather, is a very contemplative text that addresses both the pros and cons of civilization. And ultimately, it is a very psychological, very cerebral text written in a style of writing that was very, very popular back at that time, which was Impressionism, which was most famously associated with writers like Conrad and Virginia Woolf. And it's this impressionistic style that moves away from what you would consider third-person omniscient narration and focuses much more narrowly on the senses and the particular experiences, the emotional experiences of one character. And in this case, that character is the protagonist, Charles Marlowe, who is introduced in The Heart of Darkness and would actually go on to be a recurring character in some of Joseph Conrad's later works. So with all of this background just filled in, let's begin discussing the plot of The Heart of Darkness. The story begins in England, at the port of Gravesend on the estuary of the Thames, where the tale's protagonist, Charles Marlowe, is aboard a boat with a small company of travellers. But due to the tides, they cannot sail on the Thames. That river, we are reminded by the text, had known and served all the men of whom the nation is proud, from Sir Francis Drake to Sir John Franklin, knights all, titled and untitled, the great knight-errant of the sea. It had borne all the ships whose names are the jewels flashing in the night of time, from the Golden Hind returning with her rotund flanks full of treasure, to be visited by the Queen's Highness and thus pass out of the gigantic tale to the Erebus and Terror, bound on other conquests and that never returned. It had known the ships and the men. They had sailed from Deptford, from Greenwich, from Erith. The adventurers and settlers, kingships and the ships of men on Change, captains, admirals, the dark interlopers of the Eastern trade, and the commissioned generals of East India fleets, hunters for gold or pursuers of fame. They all had gone out on that stream, bearing the sword and often the torch, messengers of the might within the land, bearers of a spark from the sacred fire. What greatness had not floated on the ebb of that river into the mystery of an unknown earth, the dreams of men, the seeds of commonwealths, the germs of empires. The company on board the ship lazily exchange a few pleasantries, but the atmosphere is cold, and they soon succumb to silence. Marlowe positions himself on the floor, sat with his legs crossed and his palms open, like an idol of the Buddha, and begins to speak, providing a sermon to no one in particular. He pontificates on Britain's history and the Roman legions who had once come to its shores nearly 2 millennia ago. What must they have felt when they first gazed upon its marshes and savage tribes? Marlowe suggests the Romans would have found ancient Britannia to be an abomination. Mind, none of us would feel exactly like this. What saves us is efficiency, the devotion to efficiency. But these chaps were not much account, really. They were not colonists. Their administration was merely a squeeze and nothing more, I suspect. They were conquerors. And for that, you only want brute force, nothing to boast of when you have it, since your strength is just an accident arising from the weakness of others. They grabbed what they could get for the sake of what was to be got. It was just robbery with violence, aggravated murder on a great scale, and men going at it blind, as is very proper for those who tackle the darkness. But Marlowe concedes that there is an insatiable drive in the human character for adventure and discovery, and recollects memories of his childhood, gazing with wanderlust at the unmapped interiors of the southern world, South America, Australia, Africa. And one day, after many a voyage to the world's exotic corners, an opportunity arises for Marlowe to travel to the African Congo, the heart of darkness. The murder of a Danish captain left a place open with a Belgian ivory trading company. After Marlowe is given the job, he sails on a French steamer, pausing at intervals to allow soldiers and clerks and more soldiers to disembark at various coastal outposts. Eventually, his steamer reaches the mouth of the Congo River and starts down its path. Marlowe is introduced to colleagues and traders. It is a bitter introduction, with a Swedish captain commenting that a man had hanged himself just the other day. A railway is being built nearby with the labour of native Africans. Assessing their condition, Marlowe pitiably observes that they were dying slowly. It was very clear. They were not enemies. They were not criminals. They were nothing earthly now. Nothing but black shadows of disease and starvation, lying confusedly in the greenish gloom. Brought from all the recesses of the coast and all the legalities of time and contracts. Lost in uncongenial surroundings. Fed on unfamiliar food. They sickened. Became inefficient. And were then allowed to crawl away and rest. These moribund shapes were free as air and nearly as thin. I began to distinguish the gleam of the eyes under the trees, Then, glancing down, I saw a face near my hand. The black bones reclined at full length, with one shoulder against a tree. And slowly, the eyelids rose, and the sunken eyes looked up at me. Enormous and vacant, a kind of blind, white flicker in the depths of the orbs, which died out slowly. The man seemed young, almost a boy, but you know, with them it's hard to tell. I found nothing else to do but to offer him one of my good Swede ship biscuits I had in my pocket. The fingers closed slowly on it and held. There was no other movement, and no other glance. Marlowe then reaches the company station, whereupon he meets the impeccably dressed and groomed accountant, the visible personification of civilized man in the wild, uncultivated Congo. It is from this account that Marlowe first hears of the man who will become his obsession, Mr. Kurtz. A man esteemed as remarkable. He learns that Kurtz is positioned much further down the river in true ivory country. The accountant asserts that, oh, he will go far, very far. He will be a remarkable somebody in the administration before long. They above, the Council of Europe, you know, mean him to be. To reach the navigable part of the Congo River, Marlowe then endures a 200-mile walk overland until he reaches another outpost, where he then meets the manager, a very ordinary man. He explains to Marlowe that there has been trouble in the interior and that Kurtz is ill. Though Marlowe suspects that not all is as it seems, he is tasked with sailing into the interior to retrieve Kurtz and the ivory. Though Kurtz may be suffering, the manager shows no great haste to retrieve him. Over time, Marlowe comes to understand that the manager wants Kurtz to die, being bitterly jealous of his talents and the prospects of promotion. Repairs on the steamer are slow. Eventually, a group known as the El Dorado Exploring Expedition comes through with necessary materials. Their talk, however, was a talk of sordid buccaneers. It was reckless without hardiness, greedy without audacity, and cruel without courage. There was not an atom of foresight or of serious intention in the whole batch of them. And they did not seem aware these things are wanted for the work of the world. To tear treasure out of the bowels of the land was their desire, with no more moral purpose at the back of it than there is in the burglar breaking into a safe. Who paid the expenses of the noble enterprise? I don't know. But the uncle of our manager was leader of that lot. Eventually, Marlowe and the manager set out with four pilgrims and a troop of natives on an odyssey to the heart of darkness to find Kurtz. The Africans were cannibals, and Marlowe dryly remarks of them that they were men one could work with, and I am grateful to them. And after all, they did not eat each other before my face. Further on, in a thick fog, the steamer is assaulted by a tribe of native Africans. Arrows fly, and the African crew member steering the ship is killed. The natives then retreat back into the impenetrable camouflage of the forest. Sluggishly, they persevere on until they reach the inner station. They are greeted by a Russian, Kurtz's last man. He speaks with Marlowe, telling him of Kurtz's long expeditions and the local tribe submitting to his power. He was not afraid of the natives. They would not stir till Mr. Kurtz gave the word. His ascendancy was extraordinary. The camps of these people surrounding the place and the chiefs came every day to see him. Before long, some African tribesmen come to the outpost bearing a sickly, malnourished Kurtz, with a host of armed men following behind them. He's taken to his cabin. In a fleeting scene, a Congolese woman passes by, obviously a mistress of Kurtz, but seeing the European arrivals, she returns to the wilderness. The manager voices his distaste at Kurtz's operation, and it becomes clear that he is aware of Marlowe's strange sense of loyalty to this sickly man. The Russian then reveals to Marlowe that it was Kurtz who had ordered the recent attack on the boat, for fearing of being taken away. Night falls, darkness at the heart of darkness. Marlowe is jolted awake suddenly by a sense of trouble. Kurtz is missing. Marlowe finds him crawling away, bemoaning the fact that he had immense plans, and Marlowe recalls, "I tried to break the spell, the heavy, mute spell of the wilderness that seemed to draw him into its pitiless breast by the awakening of forgotten and brutal instincts, by the memory of gratified and monstrous passions. This alone, I was convinced, had driven him out to the edge of the forest, to the bush, towards a gleam of fires, the throb of drums, the drone of weird incantations. This alone had beguiled his unlawful soul beyond the bounds of permitted aspirations. Forlorn, Kurtz and the Ivory are brought aboard the vessel, and they begin the journey back. Between his duties, Marlowe visits the cabin for what will be Kurtz's final moments, to share them with this shell of a man who has diverted his whole fascination for months. Did he live his life again in every detail of desire, temptation, and surrender during that supreme moment of complete knowledge? He cried in a whisper at some image, at some vision. He cried out twice, a cry that was no more than the breath. The horror, the horror. That same evening, a small African boy comes into the men at dinner and utters that famous line, "Mr. Kurtz." He did. The manager seizes most of Kurtz's papers, but Marlowe manages to save a few letters and a picture of his once betrothed. Upon returning to London, the fiancé meets with him, still adorning mourning black. She begins to divulge her most private regrets about the passing of her love. She talks lengthily of the remarkable man she once knew, and eventually asks Marlowe what his last words were, and Marlowe lies and tells her that Kurtz's last words were her name. "I couldn't. I could not tell her. It would have been too dark. Too dark altogether."